Hello, this is the Torg Eternity Delphi Council Debriefings, where the storm has a name. We are your hosts, Lehman, Jay, and Mark. And today we will be getting into the three pillars of role-playing games, which would be the social pillar, the exploration pillar, and the combat pillar. We'll be talking about how you can use them in your Torg Eternity games, how you might try to realize what your players like, what you like, and we'll just talk also about our own experiences. So we also want to encourage you to email us at torgdcd@gmail.com. You can send us questions or comments, and we'll read those, and we'll answer your questions, we'll comment on your comments, etc. So, Jay, let's talk about your thoughts on the three pillars and how you've seen them applied in Torg Eternity, or what you would suggest if somebody likes one of the pillars.
I personally, I think I'm pretty even keel on all this stuff. I like all three of them. I would imagine most game masters probably like all three of them, although I've seen a lot of players that definitely gravitate towards one over the other. And I think perhaps I might go a little bit further into combat than some others, because I know a lot of people like to run Torg Eternity as theater of the mind and not really worrying about exact distances and things like that. Whereas, because I play primarily on Roll20, and before this we were playing D&D and Hackmaster, which were very like grid combat kind of specific kind of games, I kind of went into that way with Torg Eternity as well. So I like to keep track of the exact movement and everything like that. However, the key with that is not getting super bogged down with it, right? You don't want to be sitting there humming and hawing about, like, can I move an extra centimeter on the screen? You know, that sort of thing. Or can I reach them? When in doubt, just say, sure. So I like to make more combat challenges that actually use terrain and things like that. Whereas in other sort of more narrativist games, like, you would use tags or something to apply those, and they wouldn't necessarily be something on the map itself. But I'm also a big fan of exploration. I think, to be honest, I think exploration is probably the most important one for Torg. Torg is all about the weird crap that you can find. And I think I've mentioned before on these, the reason I like Torg is because it is more, not rigid, but it's, you know, there's a framework for how everything works with Cosm versus and Everlaws and darkness devices and stele boundaries and everything. It's not like some other games like Nexus, the Infinite City, or like, or other like crazy reality games where it's just, what do you want to happen? It happens. Oh, it's crazy. Right. You know, so there's actual, like, boundaries to this, and each of the realities is interesting and different in its own right, but then there's still the room for other things beyond those boundaries, and that's what makes them more interesting, I find. So when you have a good foundation to build on, and then you can go explore, and, you know, in the Living Land there's all these crazy wonders, and they can be anything. Likewise with Ororish Bleeds, they can be pretty much anything you want, but you could still then return to the standard kind of realities. And then as the years go on in the reality war, you know, things will bleed together more and more, and it gets stranger. So that's the more interesting thing for it to me, is the exploration, discovering new areas, and then new ways that things can work together. And social interaction is, I think, woefully underappreciated, I guess. A lot of people seem to think, oh, charisma doesn't matter. You don't need to take any charisma skills. Maybe you have one face character and they like lift every, they do all your requisitions, and you know, the rest you don't have to worry about it. And I think personally that's kind of a victim of the scene and act structure, and often people rushing to finish like an act in one session or something like that. in reality, you can be totally social. You can play an entire game session of Torg Eternity barely rolling any skills. You could just be in role play the entire time. We actually had a game in the Living Land recently where there wasn't much in the way of combat, and it almost felt like, oh, here's the combat when it actually happened. But they spent most of the time talking to this tribe. I was mentioning the whole Reality Storm worshippers before, just trying to ingratiate themselves, figure out the different factions going on there, and all kinds of things. So there's a lot of there's a lot of potential for social interaction that I think gets slept on a lot. And I've mentioned before, I could probably do an entire podcast on just how to use charisma. Since so many people ignore it. But I think all three are important. I think all three should be used heavily, but I think exploration is probably the one that brings people to the dance for Torg.
Okay, Mark, what are your thoughts?
So when I love role-playing games. I don't care what they are. I like to pick up a new one and go, "Oh, what's this?" and start paging through it and see how the authors built and structured and put together the system that they want the players to come experience and the GMs to run. And typically, the three things that I like to try and figure out when I'm skimming through it, I'll check the chapter listing if it has one in the glossaries and other stuff, is I want to see how do they build this, how do they build characters, the skill system, which is essentially the core to the role playing for me, in my opinion, is how you build. How you build a character in the game really is a fundamental anchor for the way to me, the way the designers expected the role-playing aspect to flow from, because that two-dimensional sheet of numbers and pen marks or pencil marks, it becomes the face of who you see in your mind in the game. And the way you build those mechanical things onto that piece of paper naturally draws the player into expressing their character in a certain way. So if you have like fate, you have aspects. So when you have an aspect that is tied to, she always falls down when running. That could be an aspect, because in horror movies, when the girl is running away, she's going to trip and fall. That's a trope. So you could build an aspect on that. So the player begin the aspect system le lends you to thinking about, okay, this is the phrase I picked in the situation my character is in. Does that phrase apply? And if so, how? And how can I use that in a way that fits in with what we're doing? That's one way that system draws the player into the role playing. The skills system, which Torg has, and the adds based on the attributes, draws the player into, I have a high strength, I have a low charisma in most cases, dump stats, charisma or mind, something like that. I'm dumb and I'm ugly, but I'm really strong and nimble. So you look at those five stats and you start thinking of your character and in the terms of how those numbers fit into your mind, and then you pour it over to the skills, and those skills where you put your ads kind of again shapes the situations in the game. So the combat system is the same way. You look at the combat system, how do the dice roll? What are the probabilities when you get a probability, how much damage can I do? What's the damage on the threats or the bad guys or whatever, and evaluating the combat system. And then again, the exploration, I like to call it the discovery portion, because it doesn't matter. D&D has dungeons. You go in and you explore a dungeon, right? There's a physical location and you've got a map and you've got a map key, and when they go to this one spot, you look at that number on the map key and it tells you what's going on. Well, Torg doesn't really have that. You can do it, and I tend to do that a lot because my roots are in AD&D, but Torg doesn't really do that. Torg has a scenes and act structure in which you can make it flow from site to site, and inside an act you can put locations and then freeform how they go to which locations, kind of like scenes and whatever, but that limits you to a 3 to 5, maybe 6 locations, scenes, however you want to work that out. But it doesn't really, that's kind of taking a square peg and pounding the corners off of it to fit the round hole, because it's not really. So discovery, as Jay was pointing out, Torg is much more into, well, what's the mystery in this box, this mission, we're going to call the box a mission. What's the thing we got to learn? What do we got to discover? We've got a beginning at the mission brief, and then we're going to go through this, the course of these scenes and acts, and there are things that we're going to learn, and we're going to use those skills to discover those things. So I like discovery a lot more than exploration, because every game's got some discovery in it. And I don't know that any one of them is more important than the other, as far as, I mean, from a stool standpoint, or three pillars. If you had three-legged stool, you knock one of the legs out, the stool falls over. So you got to have all three, but can you have a shorter leg so that the stool kind of leans to one side or the other? Yeah, absolutely. Jay seems to believe he's heavy on combat. I like the discovery exploration side of it a little bit more, because to me, the story is inside of that, and I like telling stories. But the combat and the role-playing parts of it are really important, because that's – people like to roll dice, and the majority of the dice get rolled in combat. You can roll dice in exploration, but not all of the dice. You only get to roll some skill dice in exploration. In combat, you're rolling everything. You're rolling your combat dice. You can roll some skill dice. You can roll damage dice. That's the only place you're going to, generally speaking, as a player, roll damage dice. If you've got saving throws or something along those lines, those are some more dice you get to roll in combat or in those situations. Some of that happens in discovery or exploration. But then role-playing kind of ends up – I think role-playing gets a short shrift a lot, because you end up with characters or players or flavors of folks who play that either just want to roll the dice – and they don't care about how they get to the point where they get to roll the dice. They're just mechanically moving from point A to point B. And I'm not saying any of this is bad or good. Don't hear a judgment value in what I'm saying. It's just a statement. But the role-playing part, to me, is the whole point of the character, that word character. Your piece of paper should have some character to it, and that the amount that you bring to it, less or more, depends on the player. And sometimes GMs will let the role-playing aspect drive the discovery. And sometimes the role-playing aspect leads to combat or avoids combat, right? You can do both. And then that charisma character that seems to get short shrift a lot because folks are like, well, you can't really do a lot with charisma. You can avoid combat if your GM works that way. You can avoid combat with charisma a lot if you're good, right? But I don't know that any one of them, one or more, has a greater or lesser. I tend to lean towards discovery and exploration because, to me, the story's there. And then I use combat and role-playing as tools. And I like to see the role-playing aspect of it because, to me, that's more interesting than just, okay, what do I do? Where are we going? Okay, I'm going to do this. So I'm going to do that. I like getting into character, and that's fun to me. But I think in one of the things that Jay was lamenting about, the way that this comes about is, I think it comes mainly from the slot mentality in that, and this is not this is kind of the industry's fault in that organized play in con settings, you have a limited amount of time to play. Right. And so you have to squeeze this much into this much, and you have to try and figure out how to take 20 pounds of bubble gum and fit it into a 10 pound bag sometimes. And different GMs are better at that. And so we end up with, okay, we got to go, we got to go, we got to go. Okay, I'm going to cut this out. And you cut something you shouldn't have. And no, we got to go, we got to go to get all the stuff in. And at the end, everybody's like, what did we just do? And I despise that. That's why I don't, when I'm running my Torganized Play stuff, I try to not say, okay, we're going to get it all done tonight. Mm-hmm. We'll get as much done as we can, and then we'll agree when we can come back next time to finish things. Because otherwise, we're going to talk about this at some point. I feel like we're railroading people into making decisions to get to a point because we need to get to the next point, to the next point, to the next point. And I don't want to be a conductor. I want to sit back and interpret what you've done and how that rolls with the adventure so that you get to experience it the way your table uniquely experiences it. Because that's fun to me.
Yeah, I'll agree. I enjoy all three of them during my time role-playing over the years. I've gone through various, which is my favorite, even if it's subconscious what my favorite is. at the very, very beginning, it seemed to be very much math-based when I was playing back in the early 80s and such. And it was just a, I need a character that's not gonna die. And my first kind of permanent group, when a lot of other people were getting into role playing, I role played a little bit. We had very adversarial player to player type thing. It wasn't always player versus player, but there was always that chance that it could pop up. And at the time, I liked the role playing aspect of it, the social aspect. But I learned, well, I can't just have a social character, because then if I get into some type of physical altercation with another player, this was not a, if I get into physical altercation with an NPC, it was if I get into an altercation with another player character, I want to survive
Player
that.
character.
Or player character, yes, not player, sorry. I want to be able to survive. I want my character to survive. So I would come up with all these like weird off type characters, but their stats were always like min-maxed. So I would most of the time playing, you would never know that my character was min-max because I would do inopportune things or not do things to the full of my ability. But it was like in the back of my head, hey, if push comes to shove, I'm going to be able to shove back. Because when you're in a group, you have the whole group to go against the enemy. But if it's your character versus that guy's character, a lot of times the other characters will step away. Let's see what's going on if they haven't already made alliances and stuff. So that was a weird thing that I kind of went through where mentally I was all about the social, but making my character and those stats that Mark said, this should be your character. Well, those stats were combat, but the play was social. And then something that's happened within the last couple of years, which I always liked exploration, but I never really thought about it besides, oh, it's kind of fun. But I had this epiphany where I realized that it's probably like my most favorite thing of the game because, and Torg Eternity has a little bit of this where the players through cards, through Cosm cards and stuff can influence what happens. And since I've been playing Torg, since Classic Torg, that wasn't necessarily a problem or anything. But there were cases where I would be a player and the game master would ask the players, something like, hey, what do you think's in the city? And players started populating the city. And I didn't say anything like out loud because I'm a player and I'm not gonna get mad and upset a game master in his game. But like internally, I was like almost having heartburn. And I was like, is this like my game master side, like wanting control over the world? Like, as a player, seeing another game master, like, hey guys, invent things in my world. And I was like, why is this bugging me? It's not my game that I'm game mastering. And then, there's tons of content out there, different, role-playing channels, YouTube channels, and podcasts and stuff. And I was listening to somebody who was going into like really old school OSR type things, and he said something that it kind of like triggered with me at the time, which was when other people could get really into the, hey, let's make this and let's make this and let's add to the world. But that was taking away from his exploration of the world because you're not exploring if you're inventing. And that made me kind of think, oh wow, I never put those things together. And another instance, before play, we had like a session negative one, which was building the world. And I had heartburn all through that because it was, you know, all of us players going, "Hey, we want this, and we want this, and we want this, and we don't want this, but we want this." And it was because each of those decisions made by the players was taking away some future discovery that I could possibly potentially have. But it was subconscious at the time, and I didn't notice that. And again, very much like Mark, I'm not saying if that's something that you like, that it's bad. No, it's not. It's just there's a lot of times you'll read comments and say, "Oh, that's bad role playing," or, "If your game master doesn't allow you to do this, that's bad on them, and that's, you know, this is bad." And there's so many different people that view the three different pillars as more important, even if it's subconsciously. So one of the things is know what your players like and what you like as a game master, and then you can bring that out to everybody. If somebody really likes adding stuff to the world, you could have them say on the side or stuff, do it, not necessarily do it in front of the person who wants to make all these discoveries, because then it's kind of, you know, ruined for them. But if everybody likes doing it, let everybody do it. If nobody wants to put things in your world, don't think, "Oh, these people don't like my world." They might just want not to interact with the world in a way that's not through their character's eyes. And the last thing with this is kind of the social, the role-playing aspect, is you'll have people that, you know, some people really like getting into their characters, even if they don't use different voices, or some do, but they'll really get into the role playing. They'll like the long discussions and stuff. But then you have other people in other groups who they might have people that just aren't that social and are a little shy,
Or new
whether
gamers.
or are new gamers who aren't, you know, they can get intimidated by all these people talking in weird voices and doing stuff. And they might just want to roll a die, you know, "Here's my persuasion roll. And I beat the DN, so I did that." And that's not bad. It's just if you're going that way, you need to realize that your players or a player or two is like that. So that's something that if you're a game master who gives out possibilities for the people who, you know, do the best role playing, be aware that there might be some people that can be little anxiety to them, or they're not quite comfortable doing it. Because I've noticed in the past also, you can have the loud person who poo-poos everybody's ideas except for their own, talks above everybody, and because they're the loudest, the game master pays more attention to them. So also be aware of your role players and the social aspect. Do these, you know, is everybody kind of along the same page, or do you have some players you might have to focus a little more on the role playing side just to make sure, okay, you're uncomfortable with this, you can do your roles and we'll come up with, you know, stuff you said. And if somebody is really good at the role playing stuff, but they make that charisma 5, mind 5 person and expect to be able to talk their way verbally as a player out of situations, the things I've done in those types where I'd let them, you know, blab, blah, 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 and then it's like roll. And then when they fail, that's what you wanted to say, but what you actually said was, you know, "Screw you, king, I'm taking over." And now you have the guards rushing. You know, type thing. That's what you thought was going to come out of your mouth, but that's not what actually did. Because that's the other thing, is there's people, and again, really good if you like getting into the role playing and the social aspect of it, but then make your character be able to back that up. And again, I found I had faults with that back when we had that PvP personal adversarial type thing with the other party members, where I'll talk my way through anything, but when it comes to combat, here's the actual stuff on the character sheet. So you just need to be aware of everybody in your group. But again, if today somebody would say, "You can't say all three, which is your favorite?" I would say the exploration, and as both Jay and Mark have said, in Torg Eternity, a lot of the exploration is all of the weird stuff that's happening, all the crazy mixing of realities, or even in a reality, all learning about the living land when you go on first walk, and you're just expecting the Eidnos to be just sticking you with their, you know, their spears, or the pointy end of their spears, and you actually get into their religion and Lanala and Optance and Gotax, and you learn stuff. That's a really cool experience. You can get your role playing in there. You can also get your exploration as you're learning about the world, and that can apply at least eight more times in Torg Eternity, because every reality is going to have its own lore and its own unique way to explore it. So let's open it back to Jay, if there's anything else that you've been thinking about these three pillars, or as a player, or is it Torg-wise, whatever.
Well, I think it's interesting the way you were talking about exploration. I guess there's the difference between player exploration and character exploration, right?
True.
Because, I mean, even so in, and I kind of encountered what you're talking about too with more narrative games.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing Blades in the Dark with my group for a while, and it was sort of like a abject lesson in why some players are players, because
mm-hmm.
they just do not want to make stuff up, right?
Right.
So like half of my group really liked that game. Half of them was like, I hated it. I don't want to ever do it again. And that also brought up the dangers of when you try to ask someone who's not into that to make stuff up for the game, mm-hmm. and they just make up, dumb crap that they clearly were doing just as a joke, you know? So I think the nice thing in Torg is you kind of get like a little help, because right. the cards kind of prime the pump a little bit. So mm-hmm. even people who aren't very creative still get to play the cards, which is what I like. I'm not sure specifically. I don't know if I would say like I am super combat. It's just that it just happens to be what I'm more used to doing, but it's not really like the focus, because one thing I'll notice is when Mark was talking about time, and I do think that time and partially the act scene structure is one of the biggest reasons for kind of losing out on some things. I will usually cut combats more than other encounters, because if someone played a dino attack or whatever, I mean, yes, it's supposed to happen, but now miraculously the real encounter we were going to have anyway is that,
right?
You know, or we don't even have that encounter either, right? Like, if a combat is taking a long time but it's obvious that they're going to win, I will be like, fine. You know, we mop it up. Whereas for social encounters or DSRs or things like that, I will usually stick in it,
mm-hmm.
and go through. And yes, as Lehman said, like that is the classic trick of someone making a low charisma character but then wanting to role play everything to the GM and just get away with never making rolls, which is part of my TED talk about it. Like, there's sort of this kind of flies in against some of the advice that many people say. So I'll probably get downvoted for this, but one of the big things that a lot of people say in role-playing games, and Torg specific, I remember Deanna said it a lot, was like, don't make a bunch of rolls for everything. Only make a roll when it matters, right? Like when it's dramatically important. And I'm kind of the opinion personally that A, gamers like to roll dice, and B, I like making a lot of rolls during the game. However, I make sure that they are weighted appropriately. So failing these rolls isn't necessarily super bad, and succeeding at them isn't going to break apart the adventure. I'm not saying you roll the dice every time you drive your car anywhere, right? But you should have to make some kind of charisma or persuasion checks when speaking to people. if you're out there in the cyber papacy talking to people, it's not just the guy with the high charisma that has to make a check. You can't have your Idinos with his top hat or whatever trying to mask his face get away with just not talking to anyone. He still is being seen. He's got to talk to them. So I do like to make people make roles, even if they're not going to break the adventure, because this is Torg, so jammy roles either way can happen. It does potentially increase the chance for disconnection, but not really, because usually disconnection is related to spell cat like mystic castings or equipment, not so much talking and looking unless you have cyber optics or something like that. So I try to make sure to not let people get away with RPing to ignore their stats. But on the other hand, like you said, you don't want it just to be your stats too. You do want some player impact. And I have long since stopped giving possibilities for role play or smart ideas or anything like that, because people are swimming in them already, unless it's like their first game and they don't know what they're doing. People they're such a hot commodity that the people don't need the help.
Okay, Mark, any additional stuff?
So just moving on from where Jay was, the more rolls thing or the don't roll unless it matters thing, I like to run the idea that, okay, so you're sneaking. Don't roll right now. We'll assume you succeeded, or at least you think you succeeded, and then we'll call for a roll if it becomes necessary or important. And so, they're sneaking with the idea. Now the player has this in the back of their mind that, oh, I might have to roll for this. This might be important. Instead of just hand waving it all together, where if you don't call for the role, it could be just fluff, and they don't really focus on it. The potential for whatever they're doing loses importance in their mind because there's no role attached to it. And especially in Torg Eternity, because you've got possibilities and you've got cards, you have a limited resource pool for each scene, each act, depending on how you've built your character. So the more roles you call for, the more resources you're going to deplete out of your Storm Knights. And depending on how early on in the act you are, or where the dramatic part is, or the important portion of that scene, or that act, that box you're in called the mission, they may not have the resources they need to be successful or to even move the story forward, depending on how your mission's set up. So and especially that is more if you're just doing standard DN10 stuff, Torg especially, if you're doing standard DN10 stuff, it's not as important as it is when you start getting into higher difficulty numbers, or if you get into levels of success. I'm a huge fan of having levels of success be there for if you call for a reward. I think you ought a war roll. There ought to be levels of success typically for something, because if somebody does a really blows a roll out of the water, they ought to get more for it than if they just, I got a standard success. Okay, that takes more work on the game master side, but what you end up doing to your players is they end up spending more resources all the time because, oh, well, I want the best reward for what I'm doing that I can get. That typically takes a possibility or card play or both to get there. So because there's a lot of metagaming in Torg Eternity, I tend to let my players know when I call for a roll, levels of success matter on this. And now they get to make the determination of whether or not they want to put a resource into it or not. Otherwise, if any level of success is fine. Oh, okay, you hit a 10, you're good. That's all you needed. And I just, because it's player friendly, it weights itself more on the players knowing the meta stuff than other games. So I don't worry about that necessarily, but I do agree with Jay that don't beat them up with rolls all the time. Players love rolling dice, so give them that opportunity, but don't make every roll live or die, because I mean if you do, they're gonna be out of pos like you said, they're gonna be out of possibilities like that, and then boom, you don't have enough when you come to the point where it's it's do or die.
I like also doing a lot of passive stuff, so I'll write down everybody, say find, and then just, because I figure if they've made a stat high enough and adds in a skill, then that's what they're telling me as a game master, this is what my character, you know, is, this is their thing, this is what they're defining themselves at. So I'll do passive things where it's, hey, anybody who has a find over this, you notice this, and then they can look further. If they tell the others, then the others might be able to look. If nobody's done it, if everybody has dropped charisma, then they don't understand. You know, it might take them a little while to figure out why nobody's talking to them, why they can't find the person they're looking for, and try to wrap it into the story that way. But sometimes it's just, you made a character that's doing this. Go ahead. Don't worry about it. You know, we'll assume you succeeded fine enough. And I will state that's something that as a player, I appreciated in your games, Mark, when there has been times when the player has almost demanded to use a possibility. Like, hey, you know, you said the difficulty was 14. I got a 20. I want to get that 24. I'm going to spend that possibility. I'm going to spend that card. And you're like, no, you got enough. And they're like, but I want that outstanding. And you're like, you're just wasting it. Don't worry. On this one, you're getting all the information without spending the card, without spending the possibility. And that's something that's really, as a player, they can appreciate it, because then they know, is this something that I want to spend it on? Is this something I don't want to spend it on? Again, 30 years ago when we were playing Classic Torg, and it wasn't the whole, hey, things are transparent, I wouldn't tell difficulty numbers, and the players would just spend possibilities, spend cards, and they'd look at each other and like, hey, did I do enough? Hey, give me a drama card, you know, give me a hero card, I'll trade you, you know, these other ones, because we think we need higher. And sometimes they would spend a bunch of resources that weren't needed. Sometimes they thought that they had it but didn't. So there is a difference in how you set the game up. Torg Eternity is set up to be transparent in knowing difficulty numbers, knowing should I spend resources. If you, as a game master and as your table, if you like it where you don't know the defenses and you want to be able to figure that out as a combat happens, or like certain areas and threats in Rorsch will have that, no, don't tell the players on this one. If you want to go that way, you can. It's just not the default. So also be aware, if you're playing and you and your party is just not liking that type of thing, you can always change it. I mean, it worked with Classic Torg, and there is no difference, you know, in that aspect of knowing or not knowing. Just be aware that it will change how resources are spent, and what your players are going to do to try to succeed. That's another one of those things. Jay, you mentioned it really good, where there is the difference between the player exploration and the character exploration. That's also kind of similar with the social. There's the player social. Hey, we're getting around. Are you getting around with a bunch of friends? You know, talking, you know, spend the first half hour of the game session just, you know, shooting
the breeze.
You know, just talking and catching up because you're friends or whatever. Or if you're a game starts and we're in game until game ends, you know, so there's lots of different aspects in it that you'll have to figure out. As Jay also pointed out, even though social and exploration have the player and the character side, combat should not have the player side. It should be all in that, and it can be important.
Well, maybe that's your PvP.
That's where.
Yeah, you don't do PvP.
You can, you know, take out some frustration on somebody else, or get frustrated because they took it out on you. That's in Torg Eternity, you have heroes and you have villains, it's a lot easier to keep that distinction. And I think that it's just Torg Eternity wise, combat, usually because Torg Eternity is based off of movies and TV series, unless you're in, well, even soap operas, you can have like gunfights or, you know, people dying, and then they come back very close to the Nile Empire type stuff. But so much of the media out there and TV and movies have combat. So it flows very good in Torg Eternity for it to pop up now and then. I also will do the if I need to drop something because of time, I'll end combat early. I'll take that the dino attacks and wrap them up into an encounter that was already planned, or I'll just say to everybody like, "Hey, give me your combat skill, whatever you want your combat skill to be. Give me a roll," and then based on how good or bad they roll, oh, you had a scuffle with such and such, and if you had outstanding, you went through unscathed. If you had, you know, a good this thing, maybe you have some persistent shock that won't go away until you had a little more chance to do things. Very similar to how I do a lot of traveling through hazardous areas where I don't want to break it down into a scene of carnivorous plants or hiking up the mountaintop and going through that. I'll just have a general roll to kind of get a how well did you do, and then you can go forward or something like, hey, you rolled bad, take a wound or spend a possibility, you know, that type of thing, to breeze by combat a little bit. In my own experience, three games without combat will lead to some player just at the slightest noise heard will kill somebody. You know, a NPC or PC, a character, but something or someone in the game will be
Someone's got to die.
killed
Yeah,
because they're
seen
just
that.
you know, I had an investigation. It was a detective type thing. Everybody was complaining, too much combat, too much combat. We want more, you know, exploration and social and stuff. So I was like, okay, we'll have an act of, you know, all combats. And I usually get through about a scene or maybe two scenes through sessions. And so we go through the first session, and they're doing their role playing, and they're doing their exploration and learning stuff, and finding pieces of the mystery, and then the second session comes up, and they're finding a little bit more, and they're finding a little bit more. And then the third session comes up, and they're getting right towards the end of the time period that we were playing, and they like saw something through a window, and immediately throwing the spears, you know, shooting the lasers. And it was an NPC that was like climbing up through the window to give them a message. Just completely, you know, took out the NPC. That's when I learned, okay, my players, you know, even though they say that they're all for role, and they are role playing and exploration, I can't ignore the combat too much because they will make it even if I don't present it. So that's something. It's one of those things. Everybody's different, and if you figure out what your players like and what you like, you can really make a lot better decisions as a game master on how to work your adventures. And over time, learning that by those failures, you know, now it's a lot easier with those same people. If I do other groups, like when we did to organize play, then you kind of have to, might take a little while to get accustomed to those players and what you're doing and what they're doing. And in those cases, I see my social aspect go down. You know, my character will be less interactive. I will be less interactive because I'm like observing with my eyes and ears to see how other people do stuff. And then once I get into that, as Mark said, like a new player might have those anxieties. And even as a veteran player, if I'm in a new group, I kind of want to see how the group dynamic works out before I just go in being, you know, being something that would be fun to my home group, but possibly very obnoxious to another
group. You don't
want
me doing stuff that's fun to my home group.
So that's just something to think about in that. So last thoughts, Jay. We'll have all of us do our last thoughts, and then we'll wrap up.
I think one of the things you both kind of mentioned, Mark mentioned about spending all your resources on other stuff if you're doing too many rules. And I would look, as I mentioned, I'd like to think I'm pretty balanced at this. I look at the three pillars and I want players to spend possibilities and spend cards on all three of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want them to not have to spend any resources on social interaction or exploration and just save everything for combat.
Very good point. Very good point.
So in my Living Land game that I've just wrapped up, one of the things that messed them up the most was a big ravine. Ravine with rapids down at the bottom. They had to climb all the way down. They had to wade across. They had to climb up. And there was, of course, because it's torn, there's more to it than that. There's, of course, crocodile lizards in the river and lactin as they were climbing up.
Flying.
But I can't remember what they did now, but they zoomed up there like but just getting down that first part took like half an hour of them trying to figure out what to do, because they realized, hey, none of us are, they're like, why did they send us into the Living Land? Like, none of us know what we're doing. But they eventually made it. But they did have to spend some possibilities and some cards and things. So, yeah, I just don't want them to save everything just for combat and think that they can skate by everything. You want the entire world, like the whole game, to be alive and have things going on. And I especially agree with what Mark says about levels of success. I've always been a huge levels of success fan, back playing Deadlands and World of Darkness and everything, right? So I always use that. Even, I mean, obviously there are situations where it doesn't come up, like Mark said, I agree with that. No, you don't need to go any further, because it's just kind of punishing at that point for no reason. Sometimes if the play, unless they're like gunning for glory, I guess is the mm-hmm. only reason sometimes it comes up. But yeah, so I like including levels of success for different things socially and in exploration. In my original campaign for Torgaternity, a lot of it took place in Tharkold, and a lot of it was trying to go around and talk to these like gangsters who didn't like the Tharkoldu and try to set things up but still not get screwed over themselves, mm-hmm. and build up kind of like this whole resistance cell. And then at one point they actually did kill a Tharkoldu and everyone was freaking out, like, oh my god, you've killed one, we're all dead. And they had to basically then go re-find everybody and like tell them it's okay. So there's a lot of different things you can do. And a lot of it was because it all started because one person wanted to make a streetwise test to buy. Can you guess what they wanted to buy?
A law rocket.
Law rocket. So I was like, okay, well, you got to find this. So yeah, I could just say it happens, but it's better to introduce this underground smuggler guy that has the sketchy RV. He drives around and becomes an NPC, and then it becomes a recurring NPC and becomes like a whole thing. So sometimes there's a kind of like a thought that, okay, we're just going to make the roll and we'll get it. But as a GM, I like to always try to make it a little bit more. So even if it is combat or it is exploration, throw a little bit of social in there. If it's social, maybe some combat can happen. Mm-hmm. My group played a lot of cyberpunk. That's usually how it went. And even if it's social, maybe there'll be some exploration. Maybe this person's not from the Cosm you thought. Maybe you end up going, having to chase them somewhere else. So the three pillars don't have to be distinct. They can be meshed and intermingled as well.
Okay, Mark. Closing thoughts.
My general rule for Torg Eternity is called the Rule of Two. And it essentially means that what makes Torg Eternity interesting is the melding of the cosms. So going into the Living Lands and staying just in the Living Lands, to me, it can be fun, but after a time it gets boring, and it's not what Torg Eternity is all about. Torg Eternity is all about the Cyber Papacy being in the Living Land. And what does that look like? And how do your Eilish characters who are in the Living Land encountering the Cyber Papacy react to all of this? So the Rule of Two means everywhere you go, you should have two cosms interacting somehow. More so than just, I've got this one, the character, the Storm Knight is from one cosm and we're in another cosm. That doesn't count. So, I mean, sometimes it can, I guess, but what I mean by that is the Storm Knight is encountering the melding of two different cosms, and how does that uniquely play out in this scenario? The reason I bring that up is that you can apply that same mentality to the three pillars and always have the Rule of Two, as Jay was just talking about. When you have combat, okay, sometimes have straight combat. We're just bashing on things, shooting at things, zapping things, electrocuting them, spellcasting them, whatever, miracling them, however you do combat. And it's sometimes you just have to have straight, you know, force on force and let's do combat. But to me, it's a lot more interesting when you use the Rule of Two and one leads to the other, one influences the other, or the two of them come together. And what does that look like in the scenario in which you find your players? So if you can pull that off and have the social aspect in the middle of the battle, or have an exploration like in the middle of the fight, discover something, or the social aspect leads to this due to discovery, or you discover something that opens up this whole social possibility, that to me makes a much more interesting game and a much more interesting story. Jay started out with the idea that he's more on what I say is a war game mentality in feet and squares and inches. I'm more of a theater of the mind, and I think Roll 20 can do either one. Mm-hmm. So he's down for the inches and miles. I'm down for the theater of the mind. You can do both. But let me close with this. This is my last thing. If you haven't played it, you should play First Walk. If you're a game master and you haven't run it, you should run First Walk. It is arguably the single best one-act mission in Torg Eternity. It is freaking amazing. You need to find a way to play it. You need to find a way to run it. It's a great, great mission.
I would agree. It's a very awesome mission. I enjoyed it a lot. It's one of those that, again, you expect spears being poked at me, and you come out of it with a very cool understanding of Eidnos culture, or at least that one group of Eidnos, their culture, and you can learn a lot of the lore of the Living Land and the way that Eidnos think and stuff, which I think is really, really awesome. So I guess the last things I would like to say myself would be, yes, mix the pillars if you can, like both Jay and Mark said. I think I've mentioned it before. There was a situation, and when we went through our deep dive of Fires of Ra, where there is a fight between your heroes, your Storm Knights, and your villains, and then everything starts collapsing on both of you. And the thing I remember, and the thing that my players remember, and will always remember, and probably would have forgotten if not, is when that started happening, the Storm Knights and the villains looked at each other and just did kind of a head nod and went like, truce, you know, and got out together. You know, it was like a let's simmer down the hostilities, or you're not getting out, or we're not getting out. If we don't fight, we can all get out. And then it was a once we got out, okay, the villains were clearly in a they were in the lesser situation of who was going to win, and were allowed to leave, but they left defeated. And that is a moment that will be in everybody's mind for a long time, where it wouldn't have been if it was just, yeah, we beat the villains and then we left, because there was no mixing of those two aspects, those two pillars. So I think Torg Eternity especially would feel very blah if all you did was any of them. If all you did was just go in and you were the Delphi Council people who just told the Storm Knights what to do. You know, if you were the briefers, so, you know, we have this debriefings, but if you were the Delphi Council briefers and you were just role-playing, telling Storm Knights to do stuff, that would get old, I think, very fast. If you were just exploring and exploring and exploring and exploring, that could be interesting. But if nothing's being done about it, you're not doing your social stuff, so you're not spreading information, you're not making ties, you're not getting this Eidnos clan to go away from Bark-Ka, you're not finding this coven of cyber witches to help you against the Cyber Pope, things like that would also get boring. And as much as the people that I play with like combat, love rolling dice, they've also been in games where that's pretty much what it was, and did not like those games at all, where it was like after a couple of sessions, nope, that's just too much mindless combat. To go with the whole VTT thing, I find it extremely amusing that all of my classic Torg before VTTs was done Theater of the Mind. And then when I started this new campaign, we started off with classic Torg, and we were Theater of the Mind, and we met in person, and then people got jobs in different states, and other people moved, so the party split. We went to VTT, and immediately they wanted battle maps. They wanted to move. So even though we had the battle maps and the kitchen tables and stuff, Theater of the Mind, and it's still like that, the same group, if we meet in person, we will play Theater of the Mind, and if we're on a VTT, we will do grid-based combats and scenes and stuff. It's very strange. Don't know why, but that was their preference, and either way, I can work with it. So that's something also that you might think about. If you're playing in person and you need to play on a VTT or opposite, be aware that sometimes what works on one doesn't work on the other, but what works on the other one might work better than on the previous. So I know a lot of people are like, I only like playing in person, or there's some people that's like, I can only play VTT. They both have their pros and cons, and that would also be with combat and exploration. Combat, things like Roll20 and Foundry, you hit buttons, and the little macros and stuff do most of the math for you.
No looking at charts.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about bonus charts, all that. That stuff can lead to some slowdown, especially amongst new players or even old players. I have a couple of players that... Anytime we start a new Torg session, it's like I have to remind them how the bonus chart thing works. But in VTT, they can just hit that button. But in the game, they can see and they can hear, and especially because we do only audio on the VTT, so you don't get expressions, you don't get hand movements and stuff, or pointing out thing, so it's the social aspect can change a little bit. And then with the exploration, if you're doing theater of the mind, the game master, you have to be able to express things to the players. You have to be able to give them that image to appear in the mind. If you go VTT and you have maps, not just for battle maps, but like scene maps and stuff, be sure to explain some of that stuff on the scene and don't just, oh, it's there, that's what you see, because you can lose a lot of that exploration in when the players, when you've just gone on an image search and you've thrown down a map that kind of makes it, but not something 100%. There, if you don't explain what's going on, they're going to ask you what every little pebble on that battle map is.
Yeah, you always got to start with that. Okay, this is not exactly what
right.
it looks like.
Right. You know, this is kind of a rough idea. Or if you use a program and you're artistically, you know, talented and you can make it, and then you can say, yes, this does accurately depict it. Or you get something 80%, but you can ad lib, so when they do point it out, you can just ad lib what that thing is. So
see, I just take the desktop and the VTT and take the grid off. So there's no grid that implies you can move around. It's just an image that's a scene setter.
Right.
And then use the box text to try and elaborate on what that image is setting as a tone. Right. And then when the players begin to poke around, you got to start, if they're getting cold, they're moving away from the thing that you want to look at, you got to start dropping breadcrumbs in the other direction till they get hot. Or they hit, oh, you know, give me a find roll. You know, and then they, oh, okay, you see this thing, which leads them to something else. But typically, the players are pretty smart about that. They're looking around, they're looking for things, they notice the thing that you want them to notice that's there without going, okay, so the MacGuffin you're looking for is in the box in the corner. Go over to the corner. Right, because that's not fun for the players. The players want the third pillar, or one of the three pillars, discovery. They want to discover it, and players love when they're right. They love to snowball an idea of what if it's like this, and then they discover that they were right, that it is like this. They love that.
Yeah, it's just the main thing was theater of the mind, VTTs, or battle maps. Both work great. Be aware, though, they both have things that they support a little more or don't support as much. And all three of the pillars can be affected by how you present the information visually or on a table or communicate with the exploration, as we said, with the social. Again, if you're not doing video and you're not seeing the other players, you're not getting their expressions, you're just maybe hearing them. So that could take into account that things can change depending on the media that you're using, whether it's virtual, in person, if you're going battle maps, if you're going theater of the mind, even if it's VTT, there's different things that apply. So having gone through that, I think we did a really thorough discussion on how the exploration / discovery, role playing / social, and combat works, what to take into account for Torg Eternity, and when you take these ideas and other ideas out there, you can make your own Cosmverse fit your table extremely well. So having said that, go ahead and email us at torgdcd@gmail.com. And until next time, we hope you have fun in your own Cosmverse. Bye.